thanks for tuning back into our show. Before I hit go on this recording, I want to make one point about this conversation. If it sounds in any way like we are being defensive or annoyed at any of the points or criticisms or comments that were made about our subfloor, please don't think of it that way. Just understand that this was recorded at the end of a long day, at the end of a long week, and you're listening to two tired dudes talk about their floor of the house. Without any further ado, here is our conversation, kind of debriefing on the subfloor episode of our Spec House series. Welcome back to the program, everybody. We're in the shop. It's Saturday, late in the day. Long week. You have
big week.
Not even sat down for a minute. Tell us about your afternoon. I think as a general perk for the audience, we're not going to try to hold back any spoilers. Our video sequence is not caught up with our video. I'm sorry, the videos are not caught up with the actual work. And so
not today, even close.
Today, yeah. For example, was patios and roofs. And
what yeah. Else? Yeah, roofs on the back patio, starting the roof on the front patio, roof sheeting and dry-in and stapling and nailing and tar paper and tow boards and trying to get it dried in. Although it is significant, it is all of the exposure to damage is behind us, but now it's just trying to reduce exposure to having water running down the back of our neck when we're up on a roof.
For the viewers at the moment, our most recent video was on the decking, which is what we want to talk about today. And that happened right around the first or second week of July, I believe. Maybe middle of July, I can't remember. Mid-July.
You know, I was just watching a draft, and it said that we put the footings in 2 weeks before, and the footings went in like 1st of June.
Yeah.
Second week of June. So yeah, 1st of July, probably.
So from the moment that went down, really until just a few weeks ago, it was really a concern about that OSB getting wet. And that really is kind of the main part of this conversation. And probably the most frequently recurring question is, and maybe not even questions, but just opinions and people's gut instincts and and people's, just concern about OSB and it getting wet. And we tried to kind of explain our opinion on that. None of us are going to know exactly how our OSB will react, but at this point, it's behind us and we're safe, but let's talk about that a little bit. In the video, we mentioned that it does better than plywood. Is that really the case?
So it's interesting that I try to parse out the difference between my opinion and my experience and between my opinion, my experience, and input from other professionals, you know, and I fail at that all the time. But it's not so much my opinion on the durability of OSB in contact with water. It's my experience and what I have seen and what I have been paid to produce and what I have had to, the damage I've had to mitigate on my own jobs and the experience of the builders that I know here, you know, Steve Hood and Mike Zerbach and the rest who build in Southern Oregon, and the input from the engineers that I've used here in Oregon. And let me just throw that down. I have never been cautioned by an engineer when I would unroll their plans and look at their specs and the material that is being called out. I have never been cautioned by an engineer to reduce the exposure of the OSB to water. Mm-hmm. Now, that's an interesting thing. And, you know, talking to the other builders, they say, no, it gets wet and it works fine. You know, your comment, gut instinct, you look at something that's made of oriented strands. That's what OSB means, oriented strand board. And you think, particle board. Well, it is absolutely not particle board, and it is not medite. It's not comprised of sawdust and glue. And think back to early, even current, but especially early particle board. If you spilled your soda on your particle board, you better wipe it up or it's just going to drink it in like a sponge and it'll break down the bond between the glue and the sawdust and you got nothing. And you can pull particle board out of old houses that's been wet with your hand. Mm-hmm. And no slivers, no nothing. And OSB is not that. The reason that I consider OSB decking better when you're going to be exposed to rain, as I mentioned, is in my experience, and this is probably 12 years ago was the last time I used 3/4-inch tongue and groove plywood on a subfloor. And so there is zero likelihood that it was a low grade of glue. Early exterior grade plywood, CDX, the X means exterior, the glue would just fail. It would fail, and so plywood would go to pieces. But the glue now is super on plywood and on OSB. But all of that being said, I have seen and I have had to repair both inch and an eighth and three-quarter inch tongue and groove plywood subfloor where the top lamination will delaminate from the sheet when it's wet for a long time, and then you have a bubble, and it never readheres, and it's never bonded, and it has to be fixed. Mm-hmm. The OSB, in my experience, on the other hand, will uniformly swell a little bit and then go back down. Not necessarily to stock dimension, but it'll go back down. I have more confidence in it structurally on a deck than I do plywood now in the rain.
Yeah, and that's just certainly the industry standard around here. Do you know anybody putting down plywood decks, or when was the last time you saw it?
Oh, I can't really speak to that. I'm sure there are. I'm sure there are guys. But they probably, I would say that at least a portion of the guys that are still in, that are still committed to plywood subfloor have to get clearance from in their custom home building from the people they're building the home for to say, listen, I've got a pick a number. There's $1,000 in there to use plywood on the subfloor. I can pull that out if we go OSB. And if the owner is convinced that plywood is better, away we go, and we just deal with it. Yeah. So, you know, it's just a thing.
Should have read this before we got to this question, but this point could have been summed up by one of our commenters here, Alan. I got to see if I can find it real quick. Here we go.
Yeah,
Alan Calderon. If it gets wet enough to delaminate plywood, I'd hate to see what would happen to OSB. I still believe plywood to be superior in every way if one can afford it. Well, Aiden, not Alan. You're welcome to the opinion, and that's kind of the bottom line. You got to do what you got to do. Yeah. Some people referenced a video. I didn't see it from Matt Reisinger where he soaked some OSB and then was able to push nails and stuff through it. And all I could think of, I didn't watch it, but that's just not how it functions. We're not talking about submersing these products in a swimming pool.
No.
Or we're not talking about a flood event where they're literally underwater for 3 weeks. If that was the situation, it very well may be that mm-hmm. plywood would be better, but that's just not the situation that we're in here, and most people aren't.
Interestingly, yesterday, Dave Thomas, our engineer, was out at the job, and I said, Dave, let's just revisit this. Talk to me about this. And he immediately reeled out the statistical data that engineers are authorized to use and choose to use, span ratings and density and all of these things. And he said, you know what? When I added it onto my house, I used OSB. Wow. Okay. You know, de acuerdo. You know, and I see this, you and I see this the same way based on my experience. That's not based on anybody else's experience, but my own.
Before that deck went down, you spent a few weeks talking and looking and hunting and trying to find a collated automatic screw feeder gun.
Yeah.
I didn't really care too much because we had plenty of drills around and we had some good help at the time. And at the end, we weren't able to find one that was affordable or rentable, and we just went for it. But would have been nice at the same time, looking back. How do you feel about that?
So the calculation was this. You know, you can spend some number of hundreds of dollars for the machine. I've never bought one. My piecework days were all, I didn't specialize in screwing down decks, and so I didn't need it. I needed high-tech nail guns for stacking and joisting and framing, but I didn't need the screw gun because someone else came along to do that. My little remodels and additions, the floor space has always been measured in, you know, not thousands of square feet ordinarily, but hundreds of square feet. And so it's just part of the process. I never justified the purchase. What it got right down to on this was, I can buy the tool and the screws are more expensive when they're collated. So that's two expenses. And I've got these two young guys working for me. They need something to do. I'm having difficulty keeping them busy because the filming interrupts it and the site is small. And it's so my choice was this, go spend some money on the tool and leave these guys home for a day or two while that whole thing goes by, or let them come in and work and save the money by not buying the tool or the expensive screws. And so it made sense to do it that way. But it doesn't look like it makes much sense when you see us down on our knees screwing those things in one at a time.
Yeah, although it's not bad. A lot of people were making comments about how hard that is on backs, and I don't really feel that it is. Same with being on your knees. It's a perfectly smooth, brand new. It's not gravel, so it's It's really comfortable, actually. Yeah. You're kind of leaning on it. You're not lifting anything.
Yeah.
It's not really that big of a deal, I didn't think. Now, that being said, and speaking to tools, nice tools save time.
Oh, man.
That is what they do. And so in this calculation, it would have saved time and got us through it quicker, although we were never really, maybe only a couple moments, actually waiting on the screws to go in before we proceeded. Yeah. So I don't know if we would have gone home any earlier at the end of the day had we had that machine.
That's exactly the way to describe it. Wouldn't have gone home any earlier. Would have had a nice tool. I love nice tools, and I've often thought about having one of those. There's a wide range. I went and looked at one that would attach to any, you know, take your own drill, put it on there, you know, tighten it up, away you go. That makes sense. Almost did it until I saw the difference in the screw price. And so that was that choice.
I didn't think about it, and several people mentioned it, but ring shank nails being a way to hold the sheets in place. I guess it's just kind of whatever you have and you want to use, but was there anything behind
the engineer table? The engineer specified number 10 screws, and he specified the spacing.
Oh, I guess I was referring to, we use staples to hold them just kind of in place, and someone mentioned that using a ring shank would have been safer, but I don't know if that
could be one of the real it didn't take me long reading the engineer's notes and looking at Boise Cascade's notes on their iJoyce to realize those guys don't want you to split those top or bottom flanges. They were very sparing. They only want 8-penny nails driven in, even for nailing the things down to the plates, which I got permission to deviate from attaching the rafters to the plates by talking to Boise Cascade's engineer on site, and we'll talk about that later. But the calculation was this. I don't want to buy a box of ring shank nails. I have a box of staples. I want to hold the sheets where they go so I can screw them in place.
Yeah.
But the guys are right. Ring shank nails are dynamite. They really hold. They go right in. They really hold. They're a good fastener. But yeah, it didn't seem like the fix this time.
Let's talk about shims. And what's the deal with shims? It's a different material, a different type of lumber. And even if it's the same type, when it's in a smaller cross section, it seems like it's... Are they more likely to compress and shrink or rot? And, you know, we shimmed up the mud sill. We have shims under the deck holding up or making that gap. Mm-hmm. And is there anything to be concerned about, or is it truly just a wash? Is a shim as good as a piece of lumber cut to the correct size?
That's a great question. And the short answer to that question is no, it's not. But to extend that answer a little bit, we have two different types of shimming going on there. The shimming around the perimeter was done with plywood, which is dense. It's hard. It takes a comparable amount to compress a piece of eighth-inch door skin or quarter-inch CDX or half-inch CDX is what we were using. It takes a comparable amount of load to compress that as it does to compress the Douglas fir perpendicular, parallel to the grain. Okay, there's different compression strengths in lumber. When you're compressing perpendicular to the grain, that's on the end of the board, the compressive strength is astronomically high. Mm-hmm. Think of a post. Mm-hmm. Think of all those trimmers and the posts in that house now. Mm-hmm. 6x6s and big loads. When you're compressing parallel to the grain, squishing the grains closer together side to side rather than compressing the length, they do compress easier. Now, the shims, so we've got the plywood around the perimeter. That is a very hard, easily as resistant to compression as the fir or white fir mud sill below it, or the side of the plywood above it. It's a uniform sort of a thing. You got plywood, you're compressing, you're sitting on plywood, and then you get down to the plate. My opinion, that's a non-issue. The shims between the pony walls in the crawl space and the bottom of the joists were not cedar. Okay, cedar shims are soft. They cut easy. You shim your door jams, you take your razor knife, zzz, cut it, snap. Cedar is very soft and compressible. Mm-hmm. The shims that we put in there, I don't know what the species is. I rather expect they come from overseas. Dare I say China? I don't even know. But it is a much harder species of wood. I don't know if it's a deciduous hardwood tree. I don't know what it is. But it is harder than or as hard as the bottom of those I-joists and the top of that fir top plate. I didn't see any reason to back off on that at all.
Yeah, and a lot of times a shim is holding something up so you can then nail it or fasten it in its final place.
Yeah.
And so it's not just the shim holding up the world right there. It might have held it for a minute, or it might be taking some amount of it, but it's certainly not like...
Okay, there's a couple other things on that. a very legitimate objection that somebody could be saying right now is, yeah, but when you push the shim in, you're only getting bearing at the fat part of the shim, so you don't have a large surface area. You know, that's a good comment. I think I'd have to go back and remember, and certainly I intended to shim from two sides so that you don't just get the bearing on the fat side of the shim, but you get the bearing across the whole surface. So that's point one. Point two has escaped me at 61 after a long day. Oh, live load and dead load in a floor. Out in the middle of that floor, there is no serious structural load at all, except mm-hmm. where the posts transfer the loads down either to the stem wall or those mm-hmm. beams in the floor. Those are the serious loads. Mm-hmm. Everything else is the dead load of the floor itself, which is not very heavy, and the live load of the people in the space and the furniture, which is not very heavy. Mm-hmm. So the loads out across the bulk of that floor are negligible, except for the point loads, which have been transferred down to the concrete. Mm-hmm.
And even if a shim does compress, it's not going to compress to nothing. It's going to compress to some percentage of its original thing, which is, it's still helping. So,
yeah,
you know, it's
still holding the load.
Yeah.
Dave Thomas, I asked him about that months ago. He said that the engineers are allowed to accept up to, I think he said, 40 thousandths of actual compression, loss of dimension in a load before it begins to be out of spec. 40 thousandths is less than a 16th of an inch. It's 2/3 of a 16th of an inch. It's not much, but compression of wood grain is part of a structure's dynamic characteristic.
Yeah, and just the whole house in general. Right now we have a deck kind of sitting there, so sure, but once it's all sheared and kind of built into a cube, mm-hmm. there's strength and support in different parts of the house all working together. Mm-hmm. So it's it seems like these whole houses kind of work together. You know, like when you do develop a creek in one spot, there's a lot of things that can kind of be supporting that.
Let me back up and own something, though, that I am going to send Daniel under the house to add to. The comment, you know, putting the underfloor in under those joists, when I cut the middle out of that one little 2x4 cripple that was going under the beam to miss an anchor bolt, mm-hmm. that does reduce the square area that is resisting compression of that bottom plate. And as I've watched the loads add up on those floor beams, I'm thinking, I think I need mm-hmm. more posts under there. So I'm going to send him under there with some pieces of pressure treat plate to put on those strip footings mm-hmm. and some more probably 4x4s or 4x6s and some hard shims, whatever it takes to get those right up into contact, maybe a hydraulic jack to take a strain mm-hmm. and increase the cross-section of the posts under both ends of both those floor beams, because they're going to be working hard by the time mm-hmm. the roofing goes on and by the time the drywall gets in there, they're going to be working. And, responding to these questions, I hope do I sound defensive? I don't mean to. Part of that is it's been a long day, a productive day. And so, but I don't mean to. The questions and the comments are where a big part of the value of our channel mm-hmm. begins to show itself. And so, we've shown you a couple of mistakes. There's a couple more mistakes to own up to as we move forward at this point. There will probably be some more. And so I think we are at least, if not happy, we're at least willing to own what we perceive as being a shortcoming or a ball drop. But at this point, no concerns about the shims. No concerns about the water. The OSB got wet four times.
Probably
four times, yeah. And we tarped it, and we visqueened it, and we kept it pretty dry, and it's fine. I've got a couple little pressure ridges where the lateral expansion of the sheets raised the edges up a little bit, but they're going back down. And we got a comment the other day, somebody who's right on the same page with where we are. He's up on the Olympic Peninsula. Mm-hmm. They get twice as much water as we get. Mm-hmm. They use OSB, and then when it's done, they come in and sand off any little pressure ridges.
Yeah, it's not just it's not just the rain, the OSB functioning and getting damaged from rain, but even if a house has a leak in the kitchen or something, mm-hmm. plywood can delaminate and cause problems, whereas the OSB will maybe just kind of puff up and fall back down in the same place. So it's nice to have it during the construction, but I kind of feel like even years down the road, it just feels somehow
so
safer.
The exception to that is if there's a little leak that's not discerned.
Yeah.
Because OSB that's wet for a long period of time does not hold up as well as plywood.
Right.
You know, it takes a long time before the plywood being wet behind the wall or in the floor before you have to tear it. You just have to tear it out. And I don't know how much time it takes with OSB, but it's less. Mm-hmm. It's less time. And then the other thing is, and you know, under the broad general category of waving the flag when I've got to wave it, the real reason to get OSB dry quickly is because mold loves OSB. And mold and loves OSB that's wet. So you get it dry, you get air circulation, you mitigate that problem, and you push forward. But we're dry, mm-hmm. you know, hallelujah, we're dry. And so this is all interesting, but not critical information now.
Yeah, nobody in this area is too... People don't think about this debate that often. It's kind of like a generally accepted at this point that OSB is great. And I mean, maybe we'll get some of the same types of comments with sheeting and roof sheeting and stuff, but it just seems like that's what goes on houses. It's just, that's what everybody's got.
Yeah. You know, one other interesting thing comments that, how is this happening in Roseburg, Oregon, the home of Roseburg Lumber, who makes as much plywood as anybody on the planet? Let me tell you, I've installed a lot of Roseburg Lumber plywood. I have cut down trees and yarded them and loaded them on trucks, and they went to Roseburg Lumber and returned into plywood. My dad hauled for 25 years the peeler core, which is what's left over after the logs are peeled that can be put into plywood at Roseburg Lumber. We have a long family connection with Roseburg Lumber and their plywood, and I would love to have installed that, but didn't make sense. Yeah. And so this is the way we went.
We got to remember, plywood is an engineered wood product also. Plywood doesn't grow on trees, so to speak.
Right.
It's got glue in it, and it comes out of machines, and it's
great.
it's not like the difference between those I-joists and sawn lumber. We're talking about two separate engineered lumber products.
Okay, that's a great point. Remember when I used to get that dunnage all the time?
I don't remember that.
Okay, so I've had friends that work for Roseburg Lumber, and one of the things that they make available to employees is dunnage. That is plywood that's imperfect, that's got blows, that's got voids, that's mislaid, that's over thick or over thin, or corners are knocked off. They bundle that up and they sell it to the employees at a greatly reduced price. Mm. And I've had a couple of friends that would kind of enable me to step in on that, and I would use it for form plywood and all kinds of stuff.
Yeah.
And plywood can have defects hidden inside of it, that you don't see until you saw through it. Bam, there's a void, the glue is missing, it's a mislay. So it is definitely an engineered wood product, and it's a glorious product.
Yeah.
Okay, it is a glorious, take it to the bank product. But in its own area and in its own way, it is either the right thing or the wrong thing. And in this case, we think OSB was the right thing.
Another tool that was mentioned in the comments a few times is, why don't you have an electric or...
Yeah.
I guess an electric
cordless caulking gun.
What's the answer to that?
Well, first of all, the caulking gun we had on the job was a piece of junk. It was a $5 caulking gun. I'd lost my big quart good one, and it was miserable. The dog wouldn't catch in the plunger. You had to hold pressure on it, and it was a wreck, and I'm glad you got to see us thrashing with that. But here's something, and so I don't want to sound... How am I going to sound? I don't know how I'm going to sound, but how in the world are you going to get a grip if you never squeeze anything? Okay? And carpenters have a long and honored reputation for being arm wrestlers, okay? So I just don't see the wisdom of giving a young man an electric caulking gun and say, here, son, glue this down, when instead he could work the handle on that thing. At the end of the day, his radio brachialis would be puffed up and would be kind of sore, but he would be that much closer to having a handshake that you'd remember, okay? Now, does this make sense? I don't know. And clearly there are commercial applications where you're squeezing cases of caulk every day, and so why not? But on our little deal, there are some things I think where electricity, the unintended consequences of convenience sometimes are real.
Yeah, it just gets back to the conversation about tools. And yeah, if we were running caulk all day, every day, we'd probably invest and spend the money because it would be faster and better. But I'm looking one up right here. Actually, they're not that much.
I'm sure they're a great tool, you know, for a glazier, you know, somebody who's glazing storefront and, you know, who knows, or somebody who's putting down decks every day.
Right.
Okay, go for it, boys. But in the meantime, if your arm gets tired, switch hands. Build that left arm up a little bit.
I've never bought a caulking gun and then been able to find that caulking gun by the next time I need that caulking gun. They're like a consumable. It's a lot like the caulk itself. Like by the end of that job, don't ask me why, they're gone. Although, and then eventually I do find boxes full of them.
There you go, and I find them three and four and five at a time, yeah.
So I'm actually wrong, they are a little expensive. Here's the Milwaukee, it's $210, so I don't think so. Yeah. Let's just buy another cheap one for us. I guess, for this job, but they would be. I'm sure they'd be cool.
And the other thing is, doggone it, Lenny, and to a lesser extent, Daniel, need to grow some guns, okay? So have at it, boys.
Yeah. It would be kind of fun to try one of those. I wonder if you can do a better job.
Probably. I mean, there was some intermittent, you know, streaks and gobs. And,
well, the good job on the glue is not important, but thinking about like caulking trim or caulking something, that I wonder if you can really have some great control. That might be kind of a nice feature.
It'd be really nice. Okay, so here's a thing that I want to own a little bit. I've always used liquid nail, and I have no reason for that except it's what I've used.
Yeah.
And so the comments about better kinds of glue, I'm thinking, you know, I probably could have, should have, would have done a little research to see if there was a better glue to use under that stuff.
Yeah, I'm sure there is. Liquid nail's been around a long, long time, and I'm sure somebody's kind of gotten into that chemical solution and found a way to improve it.
Yeah.
But again, we don't have, I don't know if there's a big reputation of it failing.
No, there's
either,
not. There's not. But they sell it around here by the semi-load.
Yeah, you know? It's everywhere. It's like in the, when you're checking out at Home Depot, they have like a case of it right next to like the chewing gum.
Yeah.
You got to just bring a couple of boxes home. All right, I think that's about it, everybody. Thanks for listening. If you have specific questions, let us know. I'm not really sure if talking about these episodes from the Spec House is going to be the best use of this podcast, or if this would be more interesting for us to talk about things unrelated. It's hard to imagine. I guess we are like eating and breathing this house all day, every day. Yeah. So talking about it's a little bit like, oh man, I don't know if this is... But you can let us know. Yeah. We're happy to. And it's definitely a good spot to break into some of the gaps and answer questions, but certainly everything's on the table. If there's something else that you'd be interested in hearing or knowing, we will answer those as best we can. Anything you want to add?
I hope it's not circling back too far, but historically, I think it's Weyerhaeuser. I don't know who it is that makes Edge Gold OSB, but that's most of what gets put down around here. Mm. The stuff that was delivered to us, I was unfamiliar with, but I'm pleased with how it stood up.
I think it's from Canada. Is that right? Norbord?
Yep. OSB is almost entirely made in Canada.
Oh.
But there's a proprietary name, Edge Gold. I was going to check to see who underwrites that, and that probably historically has been installed more often than the other brands, but hey, it's great sauce, man.
Yeah, Norbord, where ours came from, is based out of Toronto. Mm. But look at this, an international producer, assets of almost $2 billion, 17 plant locations in U.S., Europe, and Canada. So I'd say these guys know a thing or two about OSB. Yeah. It would be cool to go to an OSB mill. I wonder if they like pour it. In those, poured out kind of into molds or?
Yeah, I've got a friend, Adrian Lachlan, who as a young man worked in one of those things. And so it triggers all kinds of memories for him to smell that. And Dave Morton, engineer here for Convay Keystone, which has been a big manufacturer of lumber handling gear for a long time, has gone around and set up the mills and showed how his designs oriented the strands by shaking. And I don't know, it's magic, but.
It's cool to think, we've mentioned this before, but all of these new, this is not a new product, but it's new within the last, whatever, 50 years. The house I live in was built in the 50s, I think, and it's small and it squeaks. And all of these engineered wood products are allowing us to build bigger, nicer homes for probably the same, you know, relative cost because we can buy, you know, these engineered wood products that can be less expensive.
Yeah. Labor drops through
down,
the floor. Yeah.
Tools go down. So all these homes built in the 50s that are like 1,000 square feet. I don't know if anybody builds 1,000 square foot houses anymore.
Right. Except for this trend right now to tiny houses or whatever they're called. But I mean, how good can that be? I don't know.
Those aren't even really developments though. Those are almost like, like playhouses. Like people move them around and shuffle them and just kind of set them down.
Yeah. We'll have to learn something about that.
I think it's just a,
maybe we build one of those.
I don't really get what you. I don't know anything about them, honestly.
I know, we'll build one for the grandkids and put it in a willow tree and make a treehouse out of it.
Playhouse or a treehouse.
Yeah.
Yeah. All right. Thanks for listening. If you have questions, put them in the comments. If you have ideas for topics, and if you'd like to send us a message, we have a widget on our website where you can leave a voicemail. And our hope is to be able to play that, answer some viewer questions live, kind of like a call-in show, except it won't be live call-ins, but find that on our website. You can leave a message, ask a question, say hi, and we'll try to maybe do a whole podcast just kind of answering some questions from viewers. Thanks for listening.